This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I dig, I cultivate. I also make Lorena stoves and briquettes, which I sell. And also it helps me bring the host community. We come together to kill this thing of conflict. We do the conflict resolution together.
That's Herbert Simon Bigo-Wani, who says he and other South Sudanese refugees in the Bidi Bidi settlement have adopted a variety of skills to cope with the food aid cuts while peacefully coexisting with their Ugandan hosts. Details coming up. Also, on World Refugee Day, the United Nations Refugee Agency appeals to nations to keep their doors open to those fleeing conflict, persecution, and abuse. And Sudan's army has been in talks to let Russia build a naval logistics base on the Red Sea in exchange for arms. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. In marking World Refugee Day, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is appealing to nations to keep their doors open to the many people fleeing conflict, persecution, and abuse. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
A record 120 million people globally have been forcibly displaced by widespread conflicts, persecution, political and economic upheaval, and climate crises. Most are displaced inside their home countries. But some 43 million are refugees who have fled across borders in search of international protection. The UN Refugee Agency reports around 30 million internally displaced people, refugees and asylum seekers, live in Africa, representing almost one-third of the world's refugee population. UNHCR spokesperson Baba Baloch tells VOA three-quarters of the world's refugees live in countries with low or modest incomes. This, he says, debunks the myth that most refugees want to get to rich countries in Europe or to the United States.
They don't. They are Sudanese refugees are in South Sudan. Let's not forget, South Sudan is also recovering from long conflict. They're in the remotest and poorest part of Chad. They have gone to Central African Republic. They have gone to Ethiopia and Egypt, trying to stay close to their homes.
Baloch says Africa has shown unbounded generosity in welcoming people in crisis, despite the many conflicts, pockets of displacement, and widespread poverty on the continent. He says the African model shows that even in the remotest places where resources are scarce, communities have stepped forward to welcome and take care of displaced populations and refugees. He says High Commissioner Filippo Grandi is observing World Refugee Day in South Sudan to remind people everywhere of the consequences of war. At the same time, he says, Grandi wishes to pay tribute to South Sudan and other countries that have suffered the ravages of war but have nevertheless opened their hearts and homes to people in distress.
He is going there to be with the community, with already South Sudanese who have been displaced inside their countries, who now are welcoming refugees and other South Sudanese who are coming from Sudan. They have opened their communities, their homes, and their land for these displaced refugees.
The UNHCR says no one wants to be a refugee. No one becomes a refugee by choice. On this World Refugee Day, the agency is urging nations around the world to show solidarity with refugees, to welcome them into their communities and help them restart their lives. UN officials say refugees want opportunities, not handouts. If given a chance, they say host communities can reap benefits from the skills and creative ideas refugees have to offer. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Washington, D.C., the Refugee and Forced Displacement Initiative is hosting an event to spotlight refugee talents and contributions despite the hurdles they face. VOA's Anthony Labruto is at the event in downtown Washington. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Anthony.
Thank you. Hey, it's good to be with you.
So, what is happening at today's event?
So it was a small group of us here downtown in person, but this conference brought together a panel of individuals that were incredibly connected to the issues of refugees because they were one. So about half of the panelists were at one point themselves refugees that came to the United States from all over the world, Eastern Europe, Africa, South America, with nothing and built these financial networks and these diaspora networks to help others that came as refugees after them. So the theme of this panel, this conference, was celebrating refugee talents and host country leadership. So how do refugees, you know, no matter where they are, positively impact host communities, and what can these host communities do in turn to have a symbiotic relationship where everyone can help each other? And so one of the biggest aspects of this conversation that I saw was the tangible work that people were doing. Each one of the panelists were actively engaged in helping the refugees, helping their refugees in their day-to-day lives.
You mentioned that it's a worldwide event honoring refugees. How are Africa's refugees specifically being recognized?
The biggest, I guess one could say, acknowledgement of refugees in Africa at this event came from the keynote speaker, Elizabeth Campbell, and she is the Deputy Assistant of the Bureau of Population of Refugees and Migration at the U.S. Department of State. And so she spoke about the policy shift that the United States in particular is having in helping in what she referred to as these legacy refugee camps, specifically in Kenya. And so these are the more permanent multi-generational camps, excuse me, like Dadaab, like Zaatari, that brought people 20, 30 years ago from Sudan, from Somalia, across Africa to Kenya. And this policy shift specifically is looking at refugees in these camps more holistically and helping solve problems more than just these surface-level hunger and lack of medicine. You know, how can refugees fully integrate into a community that their parents, even grandparents, have been a part of? You know, what opportunities can the United States and other aid agencies and other aid organizations do to actually facilitate these longstanding problems where they begin, and that's in the camps? And so what each panelist consistently pointed to, Gaius, are that the refugees have the talent, the knowledge, and the willingness to do great things in their host communities, but simply need, you know, those resources and the opportunities to succeed. And that's how these aid organizations and people like the ones on the panel can most effectively deliver that.
Now that the conference has concluded, Anthony, how does the Refugee and Forced Displacement Initiative looks to initiate changes for refugees?
So one of the things that, you know, that really consistently surprised me, like I said before, was that that the center of this conversation, something that is at the center of this conversation and the RADFI were the tangible experiences. You know, everyone had the numbers that they could point to and say, you know, here's where we are specifically helping refugees in our areas of participation. And so I'll give you a few quick examples that at least the United States is helping to contribute to that. So this year alone, the U.S. announced financing through the World Bank, World Economic Forum, an additional $10 billion directly to refugees, both in the immediate aid and long-term investment categories, in what these officials referred to as current high refugee concentration areas, you know, with the UNHCR partnership, creating a public-private labor placement program that promises to train refugees and place them in jobs that can increase their host community as well as their own financial capital. And so they actually specifically pointed to a smaller pilot program like the UNHCR one that is working in the United States that's already being implemented with Venezuelan migrants. And so that one has been estimated to help around 50,000 people. So I mean, we can certainly imagine what that's going to do in the UNHCR scale. So certainly the takeaways here at this panel, big ambitions to solve these refugee problems, but they are very much grounded in reality, positivity, and the lived experiences of refugees that have been workshopped and refined by refugees for refugees.
On this Refugee Day, VOA's Anthony Labruto, reporting from downtown Washington, D.C. Thank you for your input.
Thank you very much.
The refugees in Uganda are adopting skills to support themselves amid food cuts by the government and its aid partners, saying it's time they learn to live on their own rather than depend on aid. Many of them have taken up farming and are earning decent incomes. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
For the first 2 years of his stay in Pagirinya refugee settlement in Uganda's Adjumani district, 54-year-old Alex Luo, who fled South Sudan in 2016, got food rations from the World Food Programme, or WFP. However, WFP has been reducing rations due to financial constraints and is now prioritizing the most vulnerable refugees for food aid. This has left Alex Luo with farming as the best option to fill his family's food needs and earn some income.
So I love digging, and then this organization come in to engage us, those who they want to dig. We started first from there in the settlement. We are planting tomatoes, eggplant, so many things. We ask the citizen to give us more land so that we can exercise what we are doing. Because we come to know that that is the only way of fighting. Even not hunger alone, fighting problem. You can develop yourself. We shall be able to pay our children in school, even medicine. This may a simple treatment you can do for your family.
39-year-old Bako Milka, a mother of five, who has also lived in Pagirinya since 2016, says farming allows her to pay school fees for her children.
We are very happy because we got the money from the cassava. My children now, I even change them for the private school. They are now studying well. The one who even which is in the secondary, I even paid the school fees all.
Herbert Simon Ligowani says he and other South Sudanese refugees in the Bidibidi settlement have adopted a variety of skills to cope with the food cuts while peacefully coexisting with their hosts.
I dig. You can see my hands. I dig. I cultivate. I also have the nursery bed, which in the end of the day, I sell the seedlings. I also make Lorena stoves and briquettes, which I sell to bring income. And this is not me alone. I do it with the team. And also it helps me bring the host community. We come together to kill this thing of conflict. We do the conflict resolution together.
A number of organizations are helping refugees acquire land for farming. Albert Siminyu is the country director for Action Against Hunger, ACF, one of the organizations involved.
Host community members donated land which refugees can use to be able to increase food production. But the challenge has been the right technology to be able to open up that land quickly. So Action Against Hunger has accessed a tractor which we have brought here in Adjumani to support farmers groups to open 366 acres of land. This land is going to be used by refugees to plant food but also to start to grow cash crops so that they can increase their household incomes.
Emily Doe, the head of the WFP in southwestern Uganda, says the government and its partners saw the need to empower the refugees to become self-reliant and live sustainable lives.
If what they need is skill, we give them skills. If what they need is something for value addition, we do that so that they move on to change their own lives as well. We don't want from year to year coming to them and giving them handouts. It's about time that these people who are able to do something for themselves and change their families' lives, do something for that.
Uganda is implementing a self-reliance model for refugees for food security and economic empowerment. Hila Ronek, the Uganda Minister for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees, says the model is focusing on social empowerment and protection of refugees, diversification of their livelihood, as well as changing their mindset from entirely relying on aid.
The little resources that come to our country to support the refugee program, we now make it available to the refugees and host communities to become more productive and be able to become self-reliant, be able to feed themselves. Because the previous model has been refugees are given handouts and they didn't need to work. But we are saying today the refugees must work and produce their food. The food they eat, they must produce part of most of it. If there's anything additional the World Food Program brings them, those will be just small additional.
There is hope that empowering refugees will provide them with survival skills which they can use when they return to their home countries. Uganda hosts over 1.5 million refugees, most from South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Sudan's army has been in talks with Russia to allow it to build a naval logistic base on the Red Sea in exchange for arms. Angie Omar reports from Cairo.
The Sudanese army has been locked in a war against the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces since April 2023. Both sides are seeking international allies. As part of the effort, the Sudan Armed Forces, which controls the government, has been in talks to allow Russia to build a naval base near Port Sudan. A new deal would revive an agreement between Russia and former Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir before he was ousted in 2019. A Sudanese delegation was in Moscow recently to discuss the matter, but the Russian state-owned news agency TASS has reported no deal was reached. Khidr Haroun is a former Sudanese ambassador to the United States. He says Sudan has historically had close ties with Russia, dating back to the Soviet era. He says it needs help to fight the Rapid Support Forces.
There is a very important fact that should be known, that the source of the Sudan Air Force aircrafts and transportation means has been in Russia since the time of the Soviet Union. So in normal cases, it is very expected to have contacts between the two countries.
VOA requested an interview about the proposed Russian base from the Sudanese embassy in Cairo, but it was declined. An RSF spokesperson also declined to comment. Khidr says the proposed deal would give the Sudanese army a boost, as it needs weapons and spare parts for its Russian-made military equipment. He notes that Western powers may have concerns about a Russian base in Port Sudan, but he says they are partly to blame for not helping his government stop the fighting with the RSF. The United States, Saudi Arabia, and the African Union have made several attempts to negotiate a ceasefire, but the RSF and the army are still locked in a civil war. The United Nations has condemned the war, and last week, the Security Council voted to demand the RSF end its siege on the city of El Fasher in the Darfur region, which threatens the lives of more than 1 million people. David Durashes, an associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Security Studies in Washington, says the Sudan Army wants Russia to withdraw its support for the RSF. Russian mercenaries from the former Wagner Group have ties with the RSF.
I think that what will be meaningful for the Sudanese army is if they can get Russia to stop providing support from these government agents, the former Wagner Group, from these Russian armed groups that are supporting the RSF. And I think that would be a significant concession on behalf of the Russians, probably not significant enough to justify Sudan surrendering its sovereignty on the Red Sea. But, you know, the Sudanese armed forces are desperate right now.
The civil war in Sudan has caused a massive humanitarian crisis, with 10 million people displaced and 18 million facing acute hunger. This is Angie Omar, reporting from Cairo.
Two years ago this month, the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision that impacted the nation's political landscape, reversing its 1973 ruling that legalized abortion nationwide. Now, abortion looms as a major issue in this year's elections. VOA senior Washington correspondent Caroline Presutti takes a look at how the issue is charging the presidential campaign.
June 24, 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court reverses the ruling that made abortion legal and leaves the issue up to the states. Since then, 21 states have passed laws to limit abortions. At a recent Donald Trump rally, a man dressed in red, white, and blue with matching sunglasses stands in the middle of the street, waving a huge flag as cars pass by. Tracy Russo and her daughter stand on the sidewalk, dressed in T-shirts promoting Trump.
I'm pro-life, but I think people should have a right if they want it to be early and to be done safely and with exceptions for the birth, you know, of a baby or a mother. but it should be up to the states.
A new Gallup poll shows the Dobbs decision galvanized single-issue voters 2 years ago and continues to do so. Lydia Saad, the director of U.S. Social Research at Gallup, spoke on Zoom.
We see a record high now, 32% of the electorate saying they'll only vote for a candidate who shares their views on the issue. But again, that hasn't really changed among Republicans and independents. That stayed absolutely steady at about 20, 22%. It's Democrats who have really surged.
One of those voters is Jaden D'Onofrio.
We've seen that the right to choice and recreational marijuana are critical to the beliefs and importance of youth voters and what's top of mind for them, especially with the right to choice.
In May, D'Onofrio's state of Florida enacted one of the most restrictive state laws, making abortion illegal after 6 weeks of pregnancy. President Joe Biden called the current patchwork of laws chaos.
It shouldn't matter where in America you live. This isn't about states' rights, it's about women's rights. The person most responsible for taking away this freedom in America is Donald Trump.
President Biden has his own complicated views of abortion relating to his Catholic faith.
You had such an impression on my family.
Last week, he met with the Pope at the Vatican. The church teaches abortion as immoral, but Catholics are divided on the issue.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint.
Former President Donald Trump takes credit for the Supreme Court decision that outlawed abortion on a national level.
You must follow your heart on this issue, but remember, you must also win elections to restore our culture and, in fact, to save our country, which is currently and very sadly a nation in decline.
Saad from Gallup says it will be interesting to see whether the Supreme Court decision will change votes in November or simply motivate people to go out and vote. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
L'Afrique ne produit que 2% des vaccins qu'elle utilise et l'objectif que nous nous sommes donné, c'est de pouvoir produire d'ici à 2040.
That is French President Emmanuel Macron saying Africa manufactures only 2% of the vaccines it uses, and the aim being set is that by 2040, 60% of vaccines are manufactured on the continent. Macron was speaking at the Global Forum for Vaccine Sovereignty and Innovation in Paris as part of World Immunization Week. France, the European Union, United States, and others are pledging to contribute about $1 billion towards Africa Vaccine Manufacturing Accelerator to address the inequality in access to vaccines that plagued the continent during the COVID-19 pandemic. It also intends to increase domestically produced shots to tackle diseases such as cholera and malaria. Macron also met with African leaders, including the new president of Senegal, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, who has said he plans to establish a new relationship with France, his country's former colonial power. Included in the proposed charges is a plan to leave the Central Africa franc for a proposed West African currency called ECO. Faye met with Macron for the first time since the Senegalese leader took office April the 2nd. Senegal and France have historically maintained strong political and economic relations. However, Faye, a left-wing Pan-Africanist, has insisted such partnerships should be mutually beneficial.
VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.